advanced directives in the news recently with studies in the New England Journal of Medicine, with the five-year anniversary of Terry Schiavo in the news as well, and now a study in the American Journal of Bioethics, the April edition. And we have the authors of that study here with us today. They are Dr. Benjamin Levi and Dr. Michael Green from Penn State College of Medicine. Welcome to Kansas City to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I understand you had Oklahoma Joe's last night and you started with the barbecue.
That's a place to start and finish.
Yeah. I bet it is. First, generally, overall, what do you think about all of this discussion about advanced directives? The New England Journal of Medicine came out with a very specific study last week about how they were used within an elderly population, and that they were something that had some value. Starting with you, Benjamin, what do you think, at least, of the state of advanced directives at this point?
Well, I think that there's a distinction between advanced directives and advanced care planning. And I think rightly so, advanced directives have come under criticism for their limitations. And I think, unfortunately, what we've also seen is that the general project of advanced care planning has been subject to that same criticism. And one of the things that Michael and I are hoping to do is to provide a mechanism that joins those two processes. One is advanced care planning, a conversation, an educational enterprise, with the creation of a physical document that has utility and that has meaning. And what we hope that we've created, and we invite readers of AJOB to do, is to peruse our program and see whether, how well we've done on that.
Michael?
Well, I think advanced directives have come under a lot of fire in recent years, and it's nice to see a report that, they're not entirely worthless, and we've thought all along that there are some true benefits, especially compared to the alternative, which is not planning in advance. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when people are unable to make decisions for themselves, somebody has to make decisions, and decisions need to be made. And what's the best way to do it? Is it better to do that by relying on the physician's guesses as to what the patient would want, or maybe the family's guesses of what patients would want, or is it better to rely on a previous documentation of what the patient said they would want, imperfect as it may be, as a way of guiding the medical decision-making that has to take place? When people are at the end of life, the vast majority of them no longer are able to participate in the medical decision-making, and so somebody has to do it, and we need some mechanism for making it happen. And advanced care planning is the process for doing it, but advanced directives have been a mechanism for implementing that, and I think it's better than not advanced care planning.
So. And especially when there are going to be differences in people's interpretations of what a given individual would have wanted. And in those cases, an advanced directive can help, if it's done well, can help clarify what somebody wanted. An advanced directive serves other purposes, too. One is it's a entree for conversation, to be able to say, here is my advanced directive. Can you please discuss it with me? And that can be something that someone can do with their physician. It can be something they do with their spouse or their children or their companion. And so I think that advanced directives are really, in a sense, the beginning of the conversation. And there are problems with elevating an advanced directive as some kind of final, in a sense, non-living document, whereas it is I think when well used, it is a marker within a time period, and that if we use that marker well, then it will serve some important purposes.
Michael, one of the terms we like to use around here at the Center for Practical Bioethics is that they're removing goalposts within a process of advanced care planning. Someone making an advanced directive at the age of 45 may think very differently when they turn 65.
Yeah, absolutely. And people clearly change their mind, and their values and preferences may change as they age or as their medical condition advances or changes. And that's why it's important to revisit the conversation. I think what's important is to be in the game, though, and as opposed to not being engaged at all in the process of thinking about what one would want. I mean, one might think about it on a regular basis and have conversations periodically when situation changes. I think some of the persuasive research that has been done which has led to some skepticism, is about the inability of people to predict what life would be like in a state that's very different than their current one. And so someone might say, you know, as a healthy 45-year-old, I would never want to be alive if I was in a wheelchair or something like that. And then, God forbid, something happens and they have an accident and they're in a wheelchair and they say, oh, it wasn't quite as bad as I thought it would be, and life is fine and my quality of life is just terrific. And so there's a problem that people refer to as future forecasting, and it's a real problem with advanced directives. Because it does rely on the need to predict a future state. On the other hand, once again, it's what's the alternative?
Not only what's the alternative, but that's the premise of education. That's the premise of informed consent. That's the idea that one tries to educate oneself and then make the best decision about a future state of affairs or a future decision. I mean, do you really, are we going to impugn autonomy by saying, well, when you're 23, you really don't know what it's like to be married to this person 30 years from now? Or when you buy this house, you really don't know the neighborhood? Are we saying that one should not be able to help people make better decisions because there's imperfect knowledge with future forecasting? Or is the alternative to provide people opportunities to explore those future decisions, to help them try to understand better what it means to be living with a severe stroke, what it means to be living with Alzheimer's, what it means to be a paraplegic? And as Michael said, the notion of, it's called adaptive preference formation, when someone finds themselves in a new situation that they thought they would not have wanted, like Christopher Reeve, they can often adapt very successfully. And so we're sensitive to the concerns by the disability rights community and others not to sort of predetermine that there's something negative about those kinds of existences. And yet we want to honor people's own values. And the way that you honor their values is you ask them, you help them think through them, you help them articulate them, and you help them communicate them to other people so that when they cannot speak for themselves, somebody can speak for them.
Michael, before we start talking about your article in the American Journal of Bioethics with the fifth anniversary of Terry Schiavo's death 5 years ago, does the name Terry Schiavo still have an impact and influence how you and Benjamin and other people in this field address this situation with advanced directives?
Well, I think the name still carries a lot of weight. In the course that we teach to the medical students about bioethics, one of the subjects that we address in a much broader course on bioethics is on advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making, and we talk about Terry Schiavo in the case, and the name still resonates with students, even though they were quite a bit younger.
Well, 12
or
so.
Older anyway.
12, yeah, well, everybody's getting older, isn't that right?
but also, I think the name is known in the public vernacular. I mean, when we talk about other Nancy Cruzan and Karen Ann Quinlan, a lot of times when I give a talk and mention those names, I get blank stares. And Terry Schiavo, however, people shake their heads and seem to know what we're talking about. Some people have claimed that in the Terry Schiavo case, having an advanced directive would have prevented all the problems that ensued. But there's others who would say that that wouldn't have made any difference because there was such a disconnect between what the husband and the parents of Terry Schiavo viewed as the reality of the situation.
The family situation was so toxic.
Yeah.
It would have made things very difficult anyway.
Yeah.
But it would have clarified one thing, because there was disagreement about what Terry said she would have wanted. Now, in one of the appellate court cases in Florida, the parents of Terry Schiavo said, and this is in the transcript, that even if there was documentation that Terry would have not wanted to be on a feeding tube, they would continue to push ahead because of their views about what was in her best interest, or their interpretation thereof. So that part would have not been prevented by an accurate, sort of well-documented advanced directive. But the large disagreement about whether Terry Schiavo would have or would not have wanted to live in this state a persistent vegetative state requiring artificial nutrition and hydration to remain alive, that question could have been answered by an advance directive.
Okay, now let's get to that article in the April edition of the American Journal of Bioethics. Michael, just give us an overview of what you are asserting within that article.
Well, we have developed an interactive computer-based decision aid for advanced care planning, and this has been something we've been working on for a number of years. And what we've hoped to do with the development of this program is to simulate the kinds of discussions that might happen in an ideal world if a physician had unlimited time, unlimited patience, and unlimited ability to interact effectively with a patient about to elicit their values and preferences and so on. And so what our computer program does, at least we hope it does, is educates people about advanced care planning. It provides an opportunity to explore individuals' values and preferences and goals. And then it uses a decision aid based on something called multi-attribute utility theory to translate those values, goals, preferences into a medical plan of action that could be implemented by physicians or other healthcare providers who need to do so. And what we hope it does better than standard advanced directive forms is truly reflects people's wishes and goals and so on in a way that is meaningful and usable by healthcare professionals. And what we talked about in the article is that we think and hope that this will be a more effective way of engaging in advanced care planning than current ways, certainly more effective than standard advanced directive forms, which are much more limited. And it can be a very powerful supplement to other forms of advanced care planning, including conversations that people might have with their physicians and others. This particular article was not reporting the results of empirical research studies. It was more a discussion of the conceptual design and intent of this program and some of the goals of it. We have ongoing research going on currently where we're testing the effectiveness of this, and that we'll have some outcomes to report in another couple of years because we're in the middle of that study. But this was more laying the groundwork for explaining the justification and rationale for what we've done.
And what we've created, we should add, is in part very different in kind from what other people have done. We've borrowed and built and learned a great deal from other people's efforts towards this, from Robert Perlman to Doug Dikema and Larry McCullen, other folks who've really put a lot of effort into advanced care planning. And I think one of the things that we have done is we have expanded the discussion, the formal discussion and the formal education. And it's not going to be for everybody. The program right now is averaging 106 minutes for people to go through and finish. And that's too much for some people. And my response would be, well, if you don't have that time to devote to these deeper questions and making sure you really understand the implications of your decisions, then you may not need an advance directive, and because it may not really reflect your true values and wishes and goals. And so the downside of prior advance directives, which have come under a lot of criticism, is based on their limited nature. And what we're hoping is that without creating a 4-day marathon event that you have to go through for
advanced care
planning.
Yeah, that's what we all need, right?
Yeah. Right? There's a balance. And I think what we hope is that we've created a program that people will find useful. It's not the final program. There's a lot to be improved. And one of the things we're inviting is readers of AJOB to, after reading our article, there's an active link. They can go to our program and go through it. And there's going to be an opportunity right there online for people to give us feedback. And we welcome them.
Dr. Benjamin Levi, Dr. Michael Green, Penn State College of Medicine, thanks a lot. Good luck with all that you do here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you've been listening to the Bioethics Channel. I'm Laura LaBue. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.